someplace there's got to be a place where people are free to discuss what they know and what they don't know and to find out what they can.
Radioactive Waves is presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Together, we will explore all things atomic, nuclear, and radioactive, along with some interesting surprises from our museum's collections and connections.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Anna Part, and this month we will be celebrating Black History Month by revisiting the subject of last year's Black History Month podcast, Jasper Brown Jeffries Jr. I've actually been working since last year to secure the rights to use audio from an oral history that Professor Jeffries did in 1987 that is currently held by the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in New York City. It's actually a department in the New York Public Library system. And I am extremely excited and very honored to say that their legal department has granted us access, and now I'm allowed to share part of this amazing interview with you. So this interview was conducted by Kathleen J. Prestwich in February of 1987. This would have meant that Professor Jeffries was 75 years old during this interview. And I would like to mention a couple of things before we get started. First of all, this is archival audio. That means that it's not going to be the highest quality sound. There is not much I can do about that. Additionally, there seems to have been a passing train when they were recording this. You can, if you're listening real closely, you might be able to hear a couple of toot toots in the background. So please disregard those. It's not your phone, which is what I thought was happening when I heard it for the first time. Finally, I do need to remind everyone who's listening that Professor Jeffries' opinions are not necessarily the opinions of the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. In this interview, he discusses frankly some of his political beliefs, and these do not reflect the beliefs of the museum. We try very hard to be apolitical. We are a nonprofit, and we do our very best to present the facts without bringing any kind of beliefs into our interpretation. However, he talks about this stuff, and it's important to include that in the historical record. So just a heads up, he was not a fan of Ronald Reagan, and you'll hear about that later on in the podcast. So if you would like a fuller discussion of Jeffries' early life and a more complete version of his biography, please feel free to go back and listen to episode 9 of this podcast, because today we're really just going to jump right in. We're going to be starting with an interesting anecdote about Jeffries' experience of education in the 1930s. In this clip, Jeffries speaks about his own experience of education, and he credits his parents' strict expectations when he was young as contributing to his pursuit of a career in academia. Now I'm going to stop talking and let you hear what Professor Jeffries has to say.
If you'd like to, for a moment, contrast life as a student in your day with now, and say something about what you think is a good foundation for the preparation of life for the 21st century and or even for one who might be interested in going into the sciences. I know that's a big order, but you can break it down as you'd like.
Well, I might say that I was blessed with two parents who thought mainly in terms of the education of their sons. And I certainly, I'll tell you a little story about this. Once upon a time on the football field, I did a little swearing because it's sort of normal for football players to swear. One of the teachers in the high school took me in before the principal, and he asked me, Jeffries, were you swearing on the campus? I said, well, I might have said one or two words. He said, well, you may have your choice. You can either go home for 2 weeks or you can wash the windows on the third floor for the rest of the week. So I don't need to give you but one guess as to which one I took. I took the choice of washing the windows. So after a couple of days or so of doing that, he decided that, well, maybe I'd been able to see the light reflected from those windows. So he said, going back to class. But as I say, I wouldn't have dared showed up to have shown up on the sidewalks of Winston-Salem for 2 weeks suspension.
Yes.
There's no place to hide. So with that sort of home training,
yes,
I was able to complete high school shortly after my 16th birthday. And my brothers they weren't quite as rapid in completing high school, but they did all right. The main idea there was that we should either work or else.
Yes.
We either had to work at school or we had to work outside of school, or both.
Yes.
So there was no doubt about what we were supposed to do. And there was no harm in coming home with an A. No harm at all. In fact, it was highly recommended. We didn't always do it, but yes, it was recommended.
Yes.
Because it was, the idea there was that we should behave ourselves in school, and we were going there to learn.
Yes.
We weren't going there to give any teacher a hard time.
Of course, our main interest, this podcast's interest, in listening to Professor Jeffrey's interview is his time working on the Manhattan Project. So let's listen to that.
You got involved with the Manhattan Project?
Yes, I did. I got involved with the Manhattan Project.
And of course, the Manhattan Project, for people who don't know, was a secret operation somewhere here in New York City where you worked on some aspects of the atomic bomb. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is partially correct.
Okay.
The Manhattan Project extended over quite a bit of territory, however, from Columbia in the city of New York to Hanford, Washington, and to the University of Iowa, to Oak Ridge in Tennessee, to Los Alamos in New Mexico.
I see, but it kept that nomenclature nevertheless.
The Manhattan Project covered all of that.
I see.
Plus some others that I don't recall at the moment.
Okay.
So Marguerite DeFay, a fellow instructor at the high school where Jeffries taught physics, as well as, I should mention, Jeffries' future wife, actually convinced Jeffries to attend graduate school at the University of Chicago because that's where she was working on her graduate degree in social work. So in this next clip, Jeffries recounts his time in the Signal Corps before he joined the Manhattan Project and how he was hired onto the project.
While at Chicago, I was persuaded to enlist in the Army Signal Corps.
Oh, dear.
Yes, because World War II was
imminent,
shall we say.
Yes.
And I enlisted in the Signal Corps because of its program of training in electronics and microwave techniques, which was a continuation of my experience in electrical phenomena.
So microwave training was available that early.
That early because they were the Army and the Navy and a number of other outfits were deeply interested in radar at that particular time.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And catching up with the British and the Germans.
And the Germans, exactly.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So you were right on the forefront, the cutting edge of learning about the new technology.
I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time.
I see.
Of course, there was, as I said previously, there was some persuasive thing there. The young lady.
Good.
Marguerite DeFay.
Did you marry before you finished?
Yes, we were married. Let's see, I got to remember now, definitely.
We won't let
We were married while I was still in the Signal Corps.
I see.
Yes. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And
after you graduated, did you stay in the Chicago area?
Yes, I stayed in the Chicago area because during the time that I was in the graduate school at Chicago, in the graduate school and also participating in the Signal Corps, word got around that there was another outstanding project on foot. We didn't know what it was, but it turned out to be the Manhattan Project.
Uh-huh.
And because of the nature of the Manhattan Project, almost anyone who happened to have a degree in mathematics, chemistry, physics, or engineering somehow got word that there were jobs available.
I see. Mm-hmm. What did you do? Could you tell us a little about what your job consisted of on the Manhattan Project?
Well,
of course, you didn't know what it hooked to. But
well, simply we were on the campus, and
yes.
I was doing graduate study in mathematics in a building which was adjacent to Ryerson Hall, where they were doing research in physics. Now, that's all I knew about it at the time, and when the word got around that jobs were available on that particular project, I was still in the Army.
Yes.
But because of the nature of the project, it was possible to at least get leave from the Army or perhaps get discharged from the Army to work on that particular project. So I was sent up to meet the director of personnel.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went up to talk to the director of personnel, he wanted to know, what are we doing on this project? I said, well, I really don't know, but I have a feeling you're working on uranium. So he was a little flabbergasted, I must admit. And
how you figured it out, huh?
He reacted. I said, how do you figure that out? I said, well, while I was looking around in the library, and I just happened to look out the window, and I saw Professor Dempster unloading some
canisters,
black rods, metallic rods about so long. And I said, because Professor Dempster was supervising the unloading of those rods, I presumed they were uranium. How'd you come up with that? I said, well, Professor Dempster had just received some kind of a citation on separation of U-238 and U-235. He didn't ask me another question. He says, you've got the job.
And from then on, you had to keep your mouth closed.
Exactly.
Well, that's one way to get in. Be
yes.
observant, see,
yes.
and let the man know that you can put one and one together.
Well, I had majored in chemistry, and
sure.
I knew what uranium looked like, at least. And,
uh-huh.
Knowing about what Dempster was doing,
yes.
of course, I could put two and two together.
That's good. That's
yes.
good.
Uh-huh. So that was my introduction to the Manhattan Project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did they assign the work when you were on the project? Was it like they do sometimes here, they tell you what they want you to work on, and then they collect the data and lock it up the next day?
Among other things, but because of my training in electronics and so forth, electricity in general, I was assigned to the instrumentation division, and we spent most of our time designing instruments for counting particles, such as alpha rays, beta rays, and gamma rays. Most of my time was spent on that sort of operation.
So you were the forerunner of the different kinds of Geiger counters and meters?
Well,
and things
that
like
was
that.
One of our first things, one of the first things that I looked at was the Geiger counters and the associated electronic equipment in the nature of a computer, which would count and record
automatically.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I see. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Was there any concern that you had or the people on this project for safety in
yes.
terms of designs?
Yes, we were. We were concerned with health problems mm-hmm. in nuclear physics and so forth. And a good deal, some of our work was involved in counting the blood samples and that sort of mm-hmm. thing to determine how much exposure a good given individual had had to radioactivity.
Mm-hmm. Did film badges come out of your labs? Film badges
and all
that,
yes. Mm-hmm. Film badges and all that, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, we were fortunate in that anybody on the project, at least at Chicago, the metallurgical laboratory, with a bachelor's degree or a master's degree, had a certain rank and were considered staff members, and we were able to rub shoulders with the great ones, such as Arthur Compton, James Franck, Enrico Fermi, and associates.
Was Oppenheimer out there at the time?
Oppenheimer paid visits there, but Oppenheimer was never on the permanent staff at Chicago.
And he was more administrative and high level rather than Bennett.
Well, at that time, Oppie was presumed to be an outstanding physicist.
I see.
And what he was doing, we didn't know precisely, but later we did find out that he was at Los Alamos, and he was the one in charge of putting together enough uranium and so forth to form that gadget which was dropped on Hiroshima.
I see. Mm-hmm. Were there many minorities? Well, not many, but were there any other people that you could recall?
At the time that I was there, I was able to count to at least 13 scientists of a bachelor's degree or better, one of whom happened to be Gerianus Wilkins. Others, I have their names at hand here, which mm-hmm. I could read. But
yeah, would you mind?
Not at all.
Okay.
Well, among those other than Gerianus Wilkins, whom I have mentioned, there was Lloyd N. Ferguson, Edwin R. Russell, Marty Taylor, Benjamin Franklin Scott, Harold Delaney, George W. Reed. Those I knew at Chicago. There were others at Columbia.
Yes.
And at MIT and so forth. And I think, as I said previously, I could count up to 13 at least. But those names I may have on other pieces of paper. There were several write-ups in the Pittsburgh Courier in 1945 after the gadget was dropped on Hiroshima.
Yes.
And there were other write-ups in the Chicago Tribune and other newspapers throughout the country, dealing mainly with the so-called black scientists.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I think they were called Negro scientists at that particular time.
Uh-huh. All right.
In fact, I'm guilty of having written one or two of those articles which were sent in surreptitiously, shall we say.
Good, good, good. Yes, we have to go back and correct history. Mm-hmm. With regard to the contributions of African Americans to science and technology.
Well,
and that's one of the things I'm about.
I'm wholeheartedly in favor of it.
Yes, it must be corrected.
Mm-hmm. Here, Jeffries discusses the formation of an organization of Chicago scientists and continues on about his experience working on the Manhattan Project, as well as he talks a little bit about the security measures that he experienced both during his work and after he had moved on from the Manhattan Project.
Well, at Chicago, all of us, meaning all of those of us who had the rank of scientists or junior scientists, whatever, got together during the last couple of years on the project and organized a group known as the Atomic Scientists of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. About what year was that? End of the 40s?
44, 45, okay. Somewhere along in there.
44, 45, yes.
Mm-hmm. And all the top, the Nobel laureates and so forth, Compton and Fermi and Franck, all were members.
Yes.
And we did quite a bit of campaigning to keep the, as I say, to keep the development in civilian hands.
Yes.
That was one of our main ideas at that particular time. And I could perhaps name a few if I consulted my notes, but I remember in particular, I think he was Hungarian, Rabinovich, who took great delight in publishing the magazine, which is still in the library, so far as I can remember.
Yes.
The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists.
Right.
And that periodical would supply you with quite a bit of historical perspective. And let's see, you mentioned the idea as to how we felt personally. Most of us felt, had a hankering at being patriotic, but we were hoping that somehow we would be able to draw some conclusions to the fact that this gadget would not work. But with the explosion at Alamogordo and White Sands, New Mexico,
yes,
with Oppenheim in charge, indicated that it did work.
It worked well.
Well, it worked too well. It melted half the sand in the desert there. Louis Slotin met a lethal dosage trying to put together a critical, subcritical mass. He realized that it was going critical, and he shoved it apart with his hands.
He did?
Yes. And he died about 2 or 3 weeks thereafter. Now, Louis had quite a career. He had joined the volunteers in the Spanish Civil War. He couldn't see too well, so he was not an aviator, but not a pilot, I should say, but he did fly. He was a flight something or another, gunner or something of that sort. And when he came back to America, of course, he was an outstanding physicist. He was one of the pioneers in the study of heavy water under Urey.
I see. What was his last name again?
Slotin.
Slotin.
Capital S-L-O-T-I-N. Now, let's see. We were thinking in terms of the organization at Chicago.
Yes.
All of us were deeply interested in peaceful applications.
Yes.
But because of the war, we were also interested in outdoing the Germans in particular.
Yes.
Because we felt that with Horn and Strassmann, Meitner and Frisch, Miss Meitner by...
Yes, I remember
they made the discoveries in Germany. They tended to verify some of the things that had been done by Fermi and so forth back in 1934. Fermi really split the atom back in 1934, but he didn't realize.
I see.
He thought he had some fancy particles of transuranic elements, but they weren't transuranic elements. They were right down the middle, so to speak.
I see.
Iodine and that sort of thing,
yeah,
somewhere in the middle of the periodic chart. But Fermi thought he was beyond the chart.
Oh.
Rather than in the middle.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
And, or was it the other way around? Yes, he thought he was beyond the chart.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes, he thought he had come up with
some
transuranic elements, such as Neptunium, plutonium, and so forth.
I see.
Now, that was Enrico Fermi in 1934. Well, long about 1939, Hahn and capital H-A-H-N,
yes,
and Strassmann, the A, double S, and Meitner and Frisch discovered that they were actually beginning to produce transuranic elements bombarding with neutrons. Then they also thought in terms of splitting the atom at that particular time using neutrons. And there was this going back and forth, you know, transuranic elements and then other elements in the middle of the periodic chart, that sort of thing.
Yes.
Fragments and so on. All of that was going on. And a whole lot of us were trying to make heads or tails of that, all of that activity. Now, according to the way the military had this thing set up, we weren't supposed to know all of this. In fact, we weren't supposed to know anything at all about the explosion at Los Alamos. But we could see, feel it in the air, you know, that something had happened. Especially when we heard about Louis Slotin's death. All of us could put the pieces together. Yeah,
yes.
We could put the pieces together. Just as I put the pieces together even before I got there. And there were... I wasn't the only one who was capable of looking at chemicals and so forth and drawing conclusions.
Yes.
So let's see. There were some members of the staff who were quite far to the left.
Yes.
In fact, I got into some difficulty because I made the mistake of shaking hands with Paul Robeson once upon a time. Not that it bothered me, but it bothered them. And then there was another gentleman named Patterson, and then there was another one out of Georgia, Ben something or another.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
You know him, of course.
Yes, I don't think it was Ben Davis. Davis, yes.
Ben Davis in Georgia, and then there was another Ben Davis, the general.
Yes.
Yes. But they are not to be confused.
No, definitely.
But Ben Davis of Georgia used to talk about his father meeting in back rooms and so forth, and Ben was quite active with the far left, Georgia Ben Davis.
Yes, yes.
And there were others who were quite active to the far left, mm-hmm. and I know most of them.
Yes.
Including Robertson.
Yes.
And I was investigated quite thoroughly.
Yes.
And my mail was perused and checked with the postman. I know the postman told me that somebody wants to know about your mail. And I said, what'd you tell him? I told him you get a whole lot of bills at the face of the month. You get a few magazines. So they asked him if I got the Daily Worker. He said, no, I did get the Daily Worker. So far as he knew. See, if I got it, I bought it from the newsstand. That's what the postman told me.
Yes, yes.
But all of that was going on.
Yes. Did they go to your neighbors?
They went to my neighbors. In fact, they came to my house when I was first considered for the project. The FBI or the G2 or somebody came and knocked on the door, rang the doorbell. My wife in Chicago, you know, you open the peephole and look out the old speakeasy days. My wife looked out and she saw this gentleman there, and she said, who are you? What do you want? And so forth. What's your name? He showed her a badge and says,
Flashed it too quickly.
Yeah, real quick like. Says, I can't tell you who I am standing in this corridor. Said, may I come in? She left the chain on. He showed her the badge, which was official. And said, may I come in? So she let him in. So the first thing he asked, what's your husband doing? Oh, he's at the University of Chicago. He's doing some studying. What's he doing? He's doing research. Research on what? I don't know what he's working on. All I know is that he spends a whole lot of time in the laboratories, and he won't talk about what he's doing, but I can always find him by telephone if I need him. So that was that. Said, well, your husband's doing some important work, and we don't want you to talk about it. So that was that.
Yes.
But they continued to check, even to years later. Even when I moved to White Plains, they continued to check. They may be checking now, for all I know.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't think they've infiltrated Schomburg's collection yet. I wouldn't be too shocked if I did. I wouldn't be too shocked at all. And they came to the campus at Westchester, presumably to inquire about youngsters who had applied for government positions. But while interviewing me, he was busy checking on me.
Yes.
Not so much on the students who had applied for government work.
Yes.
And I could recognize all of this. I've been at it too long
Of course.
Not to get a feeling for it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a policy to check on everyone, but some people got checked on more than others.
More than others, yes.
Yes.
And as I say, the mere fact that I shaken hands with Ben Davis and shaken hands with Paul Robeson, that was sufficient to check and recheck.
Yes. Yeah. Well, these are the things that people need to know that become part of the whole picture of being a scientist and working on anything that is government and anything, of course, that may have war or security
implications.
Yes.
But it hurts me to realize how much ignorance we have in the White House. It hurts me.
How many billions of dollars in resources are being squandered?
Right, exactly.
To investigate things that cannot produce the desired results. What did you do after you were finished with the Manhattan Project, or they were finished with you? How did that end? After the bomb was dropped, everyone was
after the bomb was dropped, most of us had a hankering for peace.
Of course.
Yes, and most of us had academic backgrounds of some sort or other, and we were anxious to get back into academic life. Mm-hmm. And in 1946, I became a professor of physics and department chairman at what is now North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro. Mm-hmm. In short, I was back home.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Professor Jeffries continued to teach at A&T for 3 years, and he really enjoyed the work, but the pay was not good enough to support his growing family. He now had 3 children. He would eventually go on to have 4, but his family was growing, and he needed something that paid a little bit better than teaching for A&T. He received an offer to work in the engineering industry, actually building periscopes and automatic gyro compasses for the Navy in Brooklyn, and this had a much better salary. He stayed at this job for about 5 years, living in the Bronx and commuting into Brooklyn every day. That was where he said there was a considerable effort in industries to integrate at this time, and he felt like he was treated fairly as a black man doing this work. He also worked for Bell Labs briefly in Madison, New Jersey, where he was again involved in some secretive war work. So we'll listen to what he has to say about that.
What did you do over there?
Oh, we were working on one of those gadgets that was supposed to be super sacred. I can't recall the one. It wasn't the Trident, but one of the missiles.
Submarines.
Yeah, one of the missiles, yes. Mm-hmm. The Bell Labs were interested in the electronic devices and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Bordering on computers.
On
and
computers and that sort of thing.
Things move and slide and open and close automatically.
Exactly, yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yes, and the Bell Labs had just come up with the transistor about that time, and that was fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And your title in most of these places were
either
as
physicist or engineer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Here, Jeffries recounts sharing an office with a well-meaning but he uses the word unsophisticated white colleague.
I happened to share an office with a young man who was of Italian extraction, and he was quite pleased with himself that he was liberal enough to share his office with me. And we had some very fine conversations at times.
I'm sure.
At times, and one of his conversations, they got around to drawing blood from a person like Jackie Robinson. How would one get a sample of blood from someone like Jackie Robinson? I said, you'd get the same way you would from any other person. And then we'd have conversations on blacks, you know. And every now and then I'd have to ask him, I would say, now, Zappy, are you speaking in terms of blacks like Adam Powell or blacks like Jackie Robinson. Now, we have to distinguish here when you start talking about blacks. So conversations of that sort went on quite often. There was very little anger, but she seemed to be rather unsophisticated, shall we say, when it came to the racial, so-called racial angle.
And if he was unsophisticated, you can imagine what the rest
what
of the faculty
others would be,
was.
Yes.
And these people were teaching anatomy and physiology
exactly.
to potential nurses.
Exactly.
So that when we talk about the need for ethnicity on faculty to correct some of these horrendous misconceptions that go out under the aegis of truth and fact, it is, it's really frightening in 1987 that people know about the smallest microorganism in the bottom of the ocean, but they can't see and perceive people who are a tenth of the population.
Pigmentation, yes. And another thing I used to tell Zappy, he was always eager to visit me at home. So I would tell him, I said, now, Vince, I don't mind you coming around, but maybe you better put on a little burnt cork because some of my neighbors might look out the window and say, there goes the neighborhood. I used to turn the tables on him, you know.
I'd like to see the expression on his face.
Oh, well, he, he was flabbergasted.
Yes, of course.
To say the least.
Although Professor Jeffrey's environment was not always equitable, and these spaces continue to have problems with racism and intolerance, you know, he must have encountered many other colleagues who were not as, as well as students, who were not as friendly as his office mate. He was able to retire from being chairperson of his department. And in his retirement, he goes on to talk about how he enjoyed listening to classical music and talks a little bit about keeping up with science. It's no surprise that the only black scientist to have signed the Szilard petition some 42 years earlier when this interview happened continues to hold pretty strong opinions about the nuclear industry and the politics surrounding it. So we're going to listen in about what he has to say about that.
Since you retired, do you do much reading in science these days?
I do. I try to keep up with at least a bit in the Scientific American.
Yes.
I try to read the science pages in the New York Times.
Yes. What are your opinions about some of the physics, political aspects of the physicists and the engineers today with regard to our national and international policy of war rather than preventive war?
I'm glad you asked that.
Good.
There is no such thing so far as the so-called well-known physicists. There is no such thing as Star Wars that will work, according to those whom I've read about and those whom I've known personally.
Yes.
There is still a very strong organization among physicists, doctors of medicine, and so forth about eliminating atomic weapons entirely. They're a very strong feeling,
yes.
And there is some interest in building up atomic energy, nuclear energy, I should say, for power, light and heat and that sort of thing. But they're rather skeptical after Chernobyl. I'm not sure whether I got the Russian correct there or not. But we are appalled at Mr. Reagan, those to whom I talk.
Yes. Inasmuch as there are so many atomic and nuclear warheads around, should we decide tomorrow to have a freeze with a moratorium and no more production of these weapons, what could they do with all these atomic missile heads? What will they do with all this atomic material? How do they get rid of it?
It's a very grave problem. It's virtually impossible to get rid of it. But there may be some ways of converting it into fuel or something of that sort.
For some of the nuclear plants.
For some of the nuclear plants, yes. Uh-huh. There may be some ways of doing that. But the waste material, what to do with it is a grave problem.
And just the material itself.
The material itself, yes.
It's really frightening. Mm-hmm. How do you think we might go about trying to even let the public know that so many physicists and scientists, I occasionally used to run a column and write about how many have signed petitions mm-hmm. and tried to meet with the president on these issues, and he refused to meet with some of the top physicists and scientists when they wanted to approach him on the topic.
And doctors of medicine. There's a very strong organization there also.
Yes.
I can't come up with any good answers to that except what we tried to do on the project was to keep the nuclear energy out of the hands of the armed forces.
Yes.
We tried to do that, or at least to keep it under control. But that was rather difficult because the money is on the side of the military.
The government. Yes. You're talking about the Atomic Energy Commission.
Nuclear AEC, energy and nuclear, that sort of fission and fusion and all that. Yes. Mm-hmm.
You don't hear much about fusion at all anymore.
No, unfortunately. I don't know exactly how much of it is going on, but there must be quite a bit.
Yes. I know the British were heavy on fusion,
yes.
Mm-hmm. activities mm-hmm. for energy, theoretical studies, yes. and things mm-hmm. of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, there was quite a bit of it going on at Princeton, too. But I haven't seen too much written up about it mm-hmm. here recently.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt something of that sort is going on in California, and at Berkeley in particular, and no doubt at Chicago at the Argonne Laboratories and mm-hmm. so forth. I'm reasonably sure that it's going mm-hmm. on, but we don't hear too much about it.
I hope you've enjoyed this special episode of Radioactive Waves. Thank you, as always, to our Atomic History patron members who make this podcast possible every month. I hope to see you next month. And as always, don't forget to wash your hands.
Radioactive Waves has been presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Join us next time for more interviews, histories, and insights on topics like the Manhattan Project, science and pop culture, the atomic age, and the differences between nuclear fact and fiction.